You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the U.S. Supreme Court expanded civil rights protections to millions of gay and transgender Americans today, ruling that they are protected from workplace discrimination under federal law. We'll break down the decision and talk about the impact it could have around the country. First, who listens to you? As in, who takes the time to hear you out, ask follow-up questions, show genuine curiosity about what's on your mind and how you're feeling? That was one of the central questions that journalist and New York Times contributor Kate Murphy asked all kinds of people around the world while working on her book. It's called You're Not Listening, What You're Missing, and Why It Matters. Kate, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much.
Well, coming out of your book, one of the people you talk to uses the phrase a crisis of listening. Do we have a listening problem in this country?
Well, it seems like we do, because everyone I interviewed, when I asked them that question, who listens to you? I would usually get a blank stare. Just, you know, and they would think about it. And, you know, these were people who were married, who had vast networks of friends and colleagues. And there was just that hesitation. And the lucky ones could maybe come up with one or two people, maybe a spouse or a parent or a sibling or a best friend. But generally people came down on, you know, I really can't think of anyone who really listens to me. Or they talked about somebody like a psychotherapist or a hairdresser or a life coach, actually somebody they paid to listen to them. So, it really makes you wonder. You know, is there a crisis of listening? And certainly a lot of the people I interviewed said that there is. And all indications are it does seem like it's a challenge for a lot of people today.
What are we losing if we're not listening?
Oh, gosh, so much. I mean, you don't learn if you don't listen. Listening is how we understand. It's how we cooperate. It's how we empathize. It's how we connect. It's how we fall in love. You know, listening is everything. You know, you cannot have a meaningful relationship unless you listen to the other person.
If we're bad listeners, and we could talk about what it means to not be a good listener, but if we're bad at it, are we doomed or can we get better?
Oh, absolutely not doomed. That's why I wrote my book. Is, you know, listening is a skill. And like any skill, it degrades if you don't do it often enough. And so it's really a matter of practice and awareness. And the people that I interviewed in the book are really virtuosic listeners. They're the Olympic athletes of listeners, people that have put in their 10,000 hours to become really good listeners. These are the people who are like CIA agents, focus group moderators, priests, bartenders, psychotherapists. And those are the people that have practiced their listening, that have really focused on it, that it's their job, like mine as a journalist, to listen to people. So no, you're not doomed. You can absolutely get better at it.
How can we diagnose ourselves to figure out if we are good or bad listeners?
Well, I think often what happens is the other person says, you're not listening, the title of my book. That's one thing. If you're also often misunderstanding people, if you're taken aback by people's reactions, another good one that I found is, you know, if you often give gifts that are off the mark, where the person doesn't like it, you know, that you really haven't been listening to that person to know what they would like. So that's another indicator. You know, are you often, you know, getting things wrong at work? Are you often sort of feel like you're not connecting with other people, that you're just not getting it? It's probably because you're not listening.
Kate Murphy is with us. We're talking about her new book. It's called You're Not Listening, What You're Missing, and Why It Matters. Kate, I will confess to one bad listening skill that I've been guilty of many times in my life. You're listening to someone else talk and thinking, well, what am I going to say next? Because you want to, you know, maybe there's a good motivation. You want to be a part of the conversation. That is actually a really bad way to be a part of the conversation. Can you tell us how that can sabotage our listening?
Well, first of all, give yourself a break. Everybody does that. Everybody wants to be liked. They don't want to be caught flat-footed when the other person stops talking. They, you know, everybody starts thinking about what they want to say next because they want to be a part of the conversation. But what happens when you are thinking about what the other person, what you're going to say, you are losing focus on what the other person is saying. And as a result, you're increasing the chance you'll say the wrong thing when the other person stops talking. You know, just to show you're in good company, some of the research I came up with, they mapped out tens of thousands of conversations and looked at the gap between where the speaker left off and the listener launched in with what they wanted to say. And it was either a negative number, which means they started talking before the other person even stopped talking, or it was less than a blink of an eye. So that tells you the other person was spinning their wheels while the other person was talking to come up with something to say and missing a good bit of what the other person was saying.
It seems like in reading your book, part of the key here is allowing a conversation and someone else's part of the conversation to be about them and not about us, and just dedicating this time to another person. And I don't know, that seems hard for us to do in this day and age.
It is. You know, we're taught to lead the conversation, not follow it, you know, to make our mark, advance our brand, you know, stay on message, lead the narrative. But you miss out on so much when that happens. And also, it's fascinating. You know, one of the most valuable things I've learned as a journalist is everyone is interesting if you ask the right questions, if you allow them the time and the space to express themselves. And it really is. It's a great joy. And there's a lot. It's a lost art.
What are good questions to ask someone in that setting where you do want to find out more about them and keep them talking and hear this interesting stuff about them?
Well, certainly latch onto the things they are saying. You know, if they are telling a story, to get them to elaborate, get more detail. Your goal is to leave the conversation knowing how the other person is feeling and learning new things about the other person. Other questions, you know, if the conversation has kind of petered out and you're tempted to start talking about yourself instead of asking them a question, you know, really notice things about them. Ask some expansive questions. Like, for example, if somebody is wearing a piece of jewelry that's interesting, or even not interesting, ask them if there's a story about the piece of jewelry, you know, whether it's a pin or an earring or a ring. There's always a story. You know, maybe even an article of clothing they're wearing. And that leads off into all these paths. And if you can't come up with anything else, you know, one great question to ask people is, if you could live anywhere in the world for 6 months, where would that be? I love that question because, you know, you might find a travel destination you want to go to. And also that tells you a lot about the other person. Where would they want to spend 6 months? And that leads to all kinds of other questions. The one thing I would warn people against is the usual questions that people use in social situations. What do you do? Are you married? Do you have kids? What part of town do you live in? You know, what school did you go to? Because, you know, that reflexively makes the other person defensive because you're not really trying to get to know them so much as trying to rank them in the social hierarchy. It's true. And so the other person, you know, it leads to that moment where they start their CV or resume recitation or their elevator pitch, the scripted spiel that they give in these situations, but you don't get to know the other person, you know, and it's deadly dull.
I want to bring on a caller. Obed is with us in Green Bay. Obed, hi.
Hi, Rob. Big fan of your show. I really liked your conversation today. I know it's almost done, so I'll make it quick. I just had a comment how you think that in the age that we live in and our society, how it's all about us, how we focus about ourselves, that we tend to just want to talk more about ourselves and not really take the time to actually listen.
Interesting, Obed. We just have a couple minutes. I want to bring Kate in. A great question. What do you think, Kate?
Yeah, it is a great question. I think he's spot on. You know, as I said, you know, we're groomed to lead the conversation, not follow it. And it makes us lose curiosity about the other people if we're all just concerned with our self-presentation. But, you know, I'd like to propose the idea that, you know, we know about ourselves. You know about you. You don't know about the other person. And that's the real exciting thing, to find that out.
Obed, thanks a lot for that call. Kate, can you leave us in our last couple minutes with some practical exercises we could try with a stranger or someone close to us to give our listening a little boost?
Well, there's that idea of make it your mission when you meet someone to leave the conversation learning something about that person. You know, make sure that, and so when you leave the conversation, ask yourself, what did I learn about that person? And also importantly, how did that person feel about what we were talking about? So those are two questions you can ask. Another thing is, I would say that you kind of think about this idea of when you get distracted, either by your own thoughts or, you know, thinking about, you know, you need to get milk on the way home, that type of thing, to think about listening almost like meditation. So you acknowledge those distractions like you do in meditation, but then return your focus back to the speaker. You know, instead of in meditation, you might return your focus to your breathing or mantra, but in listening to another person, you're returning your focus back to the speaker.
In our last few moments, Kate, it seems like you started off in a pretty good place as a listener. Do you think you're even in a better place now after all the people you've met along the way?
I think so, yes. More than anything, it raised my awareness and probably reinforced my better tendencies towards listening. And like I said, it's a skill. And if you practice it long enough, you do get good at it. But, you know, raising your awareness just makes you exceptional at it.
Kate, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. It was fun.
Kate Murphy is the author of the book, You're Not Listening, What You're Missing and Why It Matters. Coming up, the makers of two popular boxed mac and cheese brands both saw significant spikes in sales in April, right when many of us were stocking up during stay-at-home orders. We'll talk about the history of that convenient food coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, even in 1937, convenience was key when it came to food. We'll talk about the history of one very iconic American meal, boxed macaroni and cheese. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's a story from WPR's John Davis and Brad Kohlberg about bus driving during the pandemic.
It's a chilly mid-May morning as the La Crosse Municipal Bus rounds the corner without stopping to pick anyone up. One passenger sits near the back of the bus as a sign on the front of the bus reads, "Essential Rides Only."
I'm Karen Martinez Casper. I work for Milwaukee County Transit System for 10 years now. For me personally, it has been a mix of emotions. You know, I'm really grateful that I've been able to keep working and doing the job that I love every day. But, you know, it's also been a little bit scary. You know, I have a family, children, grandchildren that, you know, I wouldn't want to, you know, get anybody sick, you know, because we are around people all day. So it has been just a real mix of emotions, but truly I feel myself very blessed that I'm still being able to work and help people get to where they're going, you know, work, doctor's offices, the store. And I think it's been working actually very well. Most of them are so happy that we are still running, because some of them said they would have had no way to get to work or to the doctor's, the store. We even got a card from a grateful passenger is how it was signed. And the passenger said that they were so happy and that they thanked us so much for, you know, being essential for them so that they could get around to their job, or they would have had no other way to go. We've been out there since this whole thing started, and we're just going to keep being out there to help everyone we can. The passengers seem to be a lot more pleasant and grateful. And I mean, I'm grateful for that too. I mean, we just want to have a good day out there just like anyone else does at their job. And I do think there's a newfound, you know, just that we're all seeming trying to help one another out there. I think a lot of people will probably still be wearing masks, the new normal. I really don't know how that's going to go, to tell you the truth. I don't really have the opinion, but I really hope people wear masks and keep remembering not to get on a bus if you're sick or even go out, you know.
Bus services across the state haven't gotten back to normal yet, but most dropped the essential rides only mandate around Memorial Day.
My name is Gary Gruen. I'm a city bus driver with Eau Claire Transit. The end of July here, I will have 12 years of service driving. Well, there's been a definite, noticeable, gradual, steady increase since the day they removed the non-essential travel only. I'm not a big fan of that, to be honest, just because this virus is not gone. It seems to be taking a little hiatus for whatever reason, maybe the season. I don't understand science or viruses. That's not my deal, but I know it's not magically gone. sometimes these things happen and you're kind of set back by them. And I'm watching it every day. I'm watching my numbers go up a little bit. But the people are still entering through the back door at this time with Eau Claire Transit anyhow. That's a big deal to me. And I'm not excited to take the next step. And I'm afraid that it's coming soon to where they open up the front of the bus for non-essential travel as well. Our passengers in our community here in Eau Claire, it's a pretty safe community. All of our passengers are grateful, you know, they're, and I mean all of them, you know, the ones on every end of our spectrum in society, class of life, whatever, you know, see that changing. I mean, you have little bumps in the road day to day from a certain passenger here and there, but overall, our community is very appreciative for what we, the service we provide.
Karen Martinez-Casper is a bus driver in Milwaukee County, and Gary Gruen is a city bus driver in Eau Claire. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Brad Kohlberg.
Now, we might think of a box of macaroni and cheese as the perfect food to feed the kids in a hurry. Some adults, maybe a lot of adults, like it too. As the coronavirus pandemic hit the U.S., sales of Kraft macaroni and cheese were up 27% in April from the same time the year before. General Mills, the maker of Annie's Mac and Cheese, saw a big increase in their sales too. The reliable comfort food has a pretty long history and was a solution to an age-old problem. Jeffrey Campbell is an associate professor in the Food Science and Human Nutrition Department at Colorado State University. He wrote the piece, An Ode to Mac and Cheese, the poster child for processed food, for The Conversation. Jeff, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, Jeff, nowadays processed foods like mac and cheese get a bad rap for some people who say, yeah, fresher stuff is healthier. In the piece you wrote, people looked at mac and cheese as a different time as a healthier alternative. Why is that?
Well, when things like mac and cheese first came out, we were still on the tail end of a time when people did a lot of their own food processing, when people didn't have access to adequate refrigeration. And so something like that was a little healthier. In fact, processed cheese kind of came about because, well, you're in the dairy state, but cheese didn't keep very well in the summertime. And so scientists were trying to figure out a way to make cheese an all-year food instead of just a winter food.
And in your piece, you talk about we humans have loved the combination of pasta and cheese for a lot longer than mac and cheese has been around. How long does that combo go back?
Well, we're not sure where it originates, but there are recipes going back 500 or 600 or 700 years. The Italians have been putting together cheese and pasta from the earliest days, since wheat pasta was part of the big diet there and cheese was part of the diet. So it's got a long and honorable history.
Well, take us back to the origins of what we now think of as the packaged mac and cheese. How did it come about?
Well, it came about with the efforts of a cheese salesman named Kraft. And Kraft started his business in Chicago, and he was peddling cheese. And business was pretty good in the winter. It wasn't so good in the summer. In fact, some merchants wouldn't even stock cheese in the summer because it went bad so quickly. So he fiddled around with ways to try and preserve cheese. And he tried canning it, and he tried putting it in jars, and he tried putting it in aluminum packages. And they all worked fairly well, but he didn't get much consumer acceptance of the product. So he started fooling around with other things, and he took some cheese scraps and emulsified them with some phosphates and came up with what we think of as processed cheese today. And it was a hit from the beginning. It was inexpensive. It was convenient. It was flavorful. It melted better than traditional cheeses. And it found a niche, found an audience right away.
Right. This was seen as kind of a liberating thing, it sounds like, because here you could have the basis of a meal for your family in, you know, 10 minutes.
Exactly. Yeah, this is processed foods get a bad rap today. As I laughingly tell my students, we badmouth processed foods usually with a mouth full of it. But it really liberated women a lot. Women's role was in the kitchen all day in a lot of circumstances. And processed foods like macaroni and cheese allowed them to have some free time, allowed them to pursue some avocations, allowed them to pursue professions. So for a lot of women, it was a godsend from drudgery.
And in this day and age, we do have, and you've alluded to this, this kind of love-hate relationship. We're suspicious of the powdered food with the sodium and all of that in it. And yet, it's something I think a lot of people, grown-ups as well as kids, turn to as a comfort food. Can you talk about that little contradiction we have there?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. We like to badmouth it, but the sale of things that are processed has never really gone away. Almost everything that all the processed foods that have been developed in the 20th century are still on the market someplace. Spam still has good sales. Tang still has good sales. Macaroni and cheese has great sales. And, you know, in tough times, foods like that that are from our childhood, they give us comfort. But boy, macaroni and cheese, it after I wrote this article, I had friends who emailed me and say, oh, I love that kind of macaroni and cheese. And these are, you know, 40 and 50-year-old people.
I see, you know, restaurants sometimes have the upscale, fancy macaroni and cheese that my kids want nothing to do with. What do you think about that, this effort to, like, take this really simple, humble classic and then make it, you know, fancier with eight different kinds of fancy cheese?
Oh, yeah, we see that a lot in restaurants, and they're just trying to cue on to the fact that everybody loves macaroni and cheese. It's really universal. It cuts across class and age and race. And so if you're an upscale restaurateur, of course, you're going to put some upscale cheese on it. If you're a farm-to-table restaurant, you're going to put some local cheesemaker, you know, artisanal cheesemaker's cheese on it. But in the end, everybody loves mac and cheese. It's something from every market segment, from quick service to fine white tablecloth dining. Everybody's in on it.
Jeff, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That's Jeffrey Campbell, associate professor in the Food Science and Human Nutrition Department at Colorado State University. He wrote about the history of mac and cheese for The Conversation. Coming up, we'll talk about the U.S. Supreme Court's ruling earlier today that said LGBTQ individuals are protected from workplace discrimination under federal law. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 6 on The Morning Show, your visit to the dentist's office might have been postponed after the last few months, and now dentists and other oral health care providers are playing catch-up with their patients. Find out how the pandemic affected dental care in the United States. That's tomorrow morning at 6 here on the Ideas Network. Now, the U.S. Supreme Court released a decision that surprised many today, ruling 6-3 to expand civil rights protections for gay and transgender Americans at the workplace. Two of the court's conservatives sided with liberal justices, finding that current federal law protects LGBTQ citizens from employment discrimination. Kimmy King is a Supreme Court expert and professor of political science at the University of North Texas. Kimmy, welcome back to the show.
Good to be back.
Did you see this ruling today as a surprise?
Yeah, I think most people, when they were looking at the calculations, figured that at best it would be 5-4. I don't think anyone expected 6-3, and probably not Gorsuch to be writing the opinion. So that was another surprise.
Now, I want to quote from the majority opinion here, as you mentioned, written by Justice Gorsuch, quoting, "An employer who fires an individual for being homosexual or transgender fires that person for traits or actions it would not have questioned in members of a different sex. Sex plays a necessary and undisguisable role in the decision, exactly what Title VII forbids." End quote. Well, let's go back now to that original law he was referring to in, I think, 1964. Can you talk about that law and why it was at the center of this case?
Yeah, so the question is, to what extent does the anti-discrimination provisions of the original law was in 1964? It's been amended over time. So to what extent does sex then include gender identity and sexual orientation? And so that's what Justice Gorsuch is getting at there, to say that the language of the original law was broad enough to include LGBTQ persons.
And that's one of the questions in the arguments and in the dissent that really played a central role here. Do we read the text and say, well, when we read the text now, sex includes, as Justice Gorsuch said, being a gay or transgender? Or do we need to read the intent of the members of Congress at the time, which I think most people agree wasn't to expand these protections to, say, a lesbian or gay or transgender people?
No, and you often see this as a debate in between liberals and conservatives, to what extent you directly interpret the text. And you take more of a literalist view of what was being done with the law. And so what the court has done today is to recognize that as part of that tableau in terms of how we analyze the law, that you take a broader meaning. And I think that is what most people were surprised by, that it would be Gorsuch, who he tends to be associated more with the liberal camp, or I'm sorry, with the conservative camp. And so by placing the analysis that he does, he has positioned himself to be one of those moderate swing voters. And that's why you see Alito really spending much of his time going after the Gorsuch opinion and really challenging him over what he sees as a violation of these more literalist principles.
Before we dig more into the legal arguments here, let's talk about the outcome. What does this ruling mean? What changes and in how much of the country?
Wow. So a lot. And like everything else with all of the other Supreme Court opinions, when they enter into this kind of social fray, there will be more lawsuits, in much the same way that we could have anticipated this after the court legalized marriage equality or same-sex marriage back in 2015. And so what this has done is to lay to rest the debate that was out there. There had been circuit splits over the interpretation of Title VII and how it applied. And so what this does is it creates uniformity across the circuits. But there will be more litigation on this issue in terms of how it applies for benefits and severance pay and a whole range of different issues that will undoubtedly be litigated.
Right. I think in all of the cases that led to this decision, they were over people who had been fired from their jobs, either because they'd identified as gay. One had participated in a gay softball league, and one came out as transgender at a work site. All the people in these cases had been fired, but then we might see different things for different types of work situations, it sounds like you're saying?
Yeah, and one of the things that will be interesting to see, in much the same way we saw with marriage equality, in Title VII law, we have this kind of bona fide occupational qualification that allows employers to take exception if for some reason you might want to have females working only with females, right? And so you will see other challenges come forward as exceptions that have been applied under Title VII now will be litigated in the context of gender identity and sexual orientation.
Kimmy King is with us from the University of North Texas, political scientist and Supreme Court watcher there. We're talking about the Supreme Court decision released today saying that employment discrimination against people on the basis of sexual orientation or transgender status is illegal under federal law. Kimmy, getting back to how we interpret why justices made that decision that they did, I think a lot of time in the media and I think in the public eye, we assume that justices who we consider conservative or liberal think about the outcome they want and then build up the legal case that they need to get there. Does this decision with two so-called conservative justices crossing over kind of challenge that point of view?
It certainly does, but it has long been the case that you simply cannot say that it's always ideology that governs Supreme Court decisions. And Justice Scalia was a fierce defender of the Fourth Amendment. He was a conservative, and he also supported the ability to burn the flag, not something that you think of as a conservative ideal. Gorsuch has been interesting, as has been Kavanaugh. We still don't have enough of a record developed on them yet, but they have not always behaved as you would expect them to be in terms of being good conservatives. And this is clearly a case where you see that split. Kavanaugh, interestingly enough, he dissented. He's one of the three that dissented. But he goes out of his way to acknowledge that while he disagrees with the court's decision, he thinks that it's something that should be left to Congress, that Congress should pass a law. It's not the place of the courts to legislate these kinds of decisions. But he does recognize that today should be a day of pride for persons in the gay and lesbian community regarding the outcome, and to recognize that it is something that's been a long time coming. So that was also striking, that Kavanaugh struck a little bit more of a conciliatory tone, whereas Alito is really angry, and you can hear it in his opinion.
There's been a lot of angry reaction in conservative legal circles, organizations that support nominations of judges, often by Republican presidents. They're thinking that, especially with Justice Gorsuch, they didn't get what they were backing here. Do you think there's going to be a big reaction to this in those circles and how they vet and promote potential judges in the future?
I think they will continue to have these kinds of challenges, absolutely, going forward. The Senate has been pushing as quickly as possible to get through lower court nominees that they see as being conservative and being consistent with President Trump's agenda. You've seen that the president has been successful so that one in five of the nominees on the courts these days have been appointed by Trump. So he's certainly been successful there. But in these high profile cases like Kavanaugh, like Gorsuch, and people will even go back and criticize Roberts. There are a number of conservatives still unhappy with his decision in the Affordable Care Act back in 2012 when he upheld it and voted with liberals. So you are continuing to see criticism against these conservatives.
We're talking to Kimmy King, professor of political science at the University of North Texas. She's with us to talk about the Supreme Court's ruling today that federal law does protect gay and transgender people from workplace discrimination. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your reactions, with your questions. What, if anything, does this ruling mean to you? Are you glad to see these protections extended to LGBTQ people around the country in the workplace? If you're a worker or an employer, call in with your thoughts and questions about what this means at your workplace under federal law. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our conversation about the U.S. Supreme Court ruling today that gay and transgender people are protected against workplace discrimination under federal law. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of this ruling from the U.S. Supreme Court? Are you glad to see the court taking this step? Or do you think, as some have argued, this should have been left for Congress to resolve? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Kimmy King stays with us from the University of North Texas. We're going to bring another voice into the conversation now. Megan McDonald is executive director of FAIR Wisconsin, a group that advocates for civil rights of LGBTQ individuals here in the state. Megan, thanks for joining us.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
Megan, what's your reaction to today's ruling?
Well, I mean, we are thrilled and, to be honest, a little bit surprised, I think, in, you know, the movement for equality. A lot of my colleagues around the country and in Wisconsin were not necessarily expecting this. We were obviously preparing for all possible scenarios. But, this is a really big deal. It's a big moment for legal equality. And we still have a lot of work to do. In, you know, many other fronts, but we're pretty thrilled with this decision.
And what are some of the next big civil rights priorities that you were just referring to for your organization?
Well, first of all, we in Wisconsin currently the state of the state law is that we do have protections in protections against discrimination in housing, employment, public accommodations, education for people based on sexual orientation, but not gender identity and expression. So there are no state-level protections for transgender and non-binary folks in any of those aspects of life. We do have a handful of local communities that have passed non-discrimination ordinances to help fill those gaps. But in the state law, that's obviously still missing. And then, this ruling will cover employment, but we don't have federal protections for other areas, including public accommodations, and so forth. So, there's still many other forms of discrimination that are still going to happen and still be legal, against the LGBTQ community. And then layering on top of that, we have all of the issues around systemic racism and, racial discrimination that happened that are, totally amplified for LGBTQ plus people of color. And then even more so for trans people of color. So, and black trans people and black LGBTQ people even more specifically. So, there are, this is an amazing step forward, and it's going to do a lot for a lot of people, but we still have, many forms of discrimination to fight at the state and federal level. We still have, many of the effects of that layering of oppression that people are facing that continues to be a really, sort of critical point for, Fair Wisconsin as the state group in Wisconsin and, working with all of our related colleagues around the country and the state equality groups and with our, national partners and groups like Equality Federation, Human Rights Campaign, and many others.
Megan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you so much. Have a great afternoon.
That's Megan McDonald of Fair Wisconsin. We'll bring Kimmy King back in from the University of North Texas. Kimmy, looking forward, in responses to this case, you and I have talked about religious liberty-based challenges to same-sex marriage. Do you see potentially employers challenging this ruling now under some kind of religious freedom arguments?
Oh, absolutely. And when I was talking about bona fide occupational qualification, this business of churches hiring only people who are of their denomination has been enshrined for quite some time as being an exception to a workplace accommodation. So you are absolutely going to continue to see more cases. It is inevitably the case that when you have these kind of expansive rulings that come down, then it becomes a whole wide range of different issues. And so I think what Megan's getting at is you're going to keep moving forward on things like public accommodations and housing discrimination and any wide number of other ways in which LGBTQ persons can be singled out and treated differently.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. John is with us in Madison. John, hi.
Hi. My name is, I'm a white cis male from Madison. I was wondering how this ruling might affect the recent Trump decision to roll back protections that for LGBT folks in getting health care.
Thanks for the call, John. Kimmy, is that one you've been watching?
Yeah, so absolutely it affects all of that. It also raises the specter of what it means in terms of military service, because there have also been rollbacks there and persons having been dismissed as well for being transgendered. I would caution people that when you're dealing with the military, that can be a little bit different. There's a whole different set of ways in which we look at military service, but without a doubt, it will be another one of the arguments that are added to the list that you cannot treat people dissimilarly.
Thanks a lot for that call, John. I want to take a few minutes to look at other stuff expected from the U.S. Supreme Court and some of the things they're not talking about. First of all, the DACA, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. Decision expected soon. They thought it might have come out today. What is at stake there, Kimmy?
so at stake are at least almost 650,000 people that are still protected by DACA. I think it's also important to point out that depending on how sweeping or how far the court goes with it, that if it does make a determination that it is effectively ended immediately, we have approximately 200,000 people who are DACA recipients that are currently working right now, that are contributing, you know, billions in taxes. But most importantly, they're kind of frontliners in COVID-19 because they're working in restaurant services or in delivery or in healthcare. And so that one is one that everybody will be watching to see how far the court goes or whether or not they do what they've done in some cases, which is to kind of take that middle road. What you've seen Gorsuch, and you've seen it again with the Roberts Gorsuch decision, do here is that they have crafted an opinion that marks a path forward. And so everyone will be watching what happens with DACA and whether or not they find some middle ground to make it not as sweeping as perhaps the Trump administration would like to see.
Now, in both of these cases, DACA and then the ruling today on employment discrimination at the workplace, Congress could have made these cases redundant, right? If they acted and clarified that 1964 civil rights law or come to some kind of resolution on DACA, this is ending up at the Supreme Court in some cases because Congress isn't dealing with it. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, and we can say that about the most controversial issues of our time, whether it's civil rights or abortion or, you know, whatever it may be, that the courts get drawn in to these conflicts because Congress hasn't found a middle ground. And that's why some people think that what the court might do is at least give President Trump some leverage to try to force some of the compromises in immigration reform before the November election, but it's just not clear that any of that is really going to happen given where we are.
And one more big thing from the U.S. Supreme Court, the court declined to take some gun rights cases that would have expanded protections for gun owners, as I understand it. What can you tell us about that, Kimmy?
Well, this has been a consistent dodging on the part of the court, and this clearly seems to be a mark of the Roberts Court that they're not going to go diving into anything unless they're ready to take on a battle. They have turned down 10 different gun cases that were in various stages around the country. So they're clearly continuing to avoid that. But then they were willing to step into this case, which had three lower court cases that had different rulings. And so now they've made it uniform.
In our last few minutes, moments, I should say, Kimmy, what else are you watching for from the court?
Oh, you know, the DACA is going to be the big one that comes down, but you still have a religious discrimination case that is still out there. And you have, I think most interestingly, the court has to see about which cases they're going to hold over for next year, which will be well past the election cycle. And so that in some ways will be the most interesting thing, case. Those will be the most interesting to watch.
Kimmy, as always, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You betcha. Love that public radio.
We've been talking to Kimmy King, Supreme Court watcher and professor of political science at the University of North Texas. She joined us today for a look at the U.S. Supreme Court's ruling today banning workplace discrimination against gay and transgender Americans under federal law. You can follow reporting on this at WPR.org. Our partners at NPR are covering that as we speak. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, from hair salons to presidential campaign rallies, many Americans are being asked to sign COVID-19 waivers. A law professor tells us what they mean and what we should think about before we sign those. A historian shares the ongoing debate from the beginning over what the United States is all about. We'll meet the author of Union, The Struggle to Forge the Story of United States Nationhood. And police shows have been a big part of TV through most of the history of TV. But does the screen match the reality? A TV critic joins us for a look at the way police are portrayed on the small screen in the midst of protests against police procedures and behavior around the country. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.